Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to Studio 471, which is our regular video interview series. A worldwide effort is underway right now to increase the cyber resilience of nations, and a key part of this is holding attack simulations that actually use the tactics, techniques, and procedures that real threat actors use. These types of exercises are held in Australia in the financial services sector. And with me today are two experts from the cybersecurity consultancy, CyberCX. So we have Diego Silva, who is a technical principal in cyber intelligence. Thank you for joining us, Diego.
Thanks for having me.
And we have Willem Mouton, who's the technical director of adversary simulation. Thanks for coming.
Hi, everyone.
So, the long name for these exercises that are held here are called the Cyber Operational Resilience Intelligence-Led Exercises, or by its easier acronym, CORI. A question for either one of you. Tell me what a CORI is and how this framework came into being.
I could take that, Willem. You might have some things to add, but so yes, it is a mouthful, but I can give you an abridged version of its history. It started back in, well, it started longer than back than 2014, but that's when we saw the Bank of England devise the scheme that was then implemented nationwide. The scheme is there to provide cyber resilience testing for the financial markets infrastructures. And they found great success in that program. So fast forward to 2020. Here in Australia, we didn't really have anything like it. So a similar scheme was devised called CORI, and that was introduced by the Australian Council of Financial Regulators. So that's composed of the Reserve Bank of Australia, ASIC, APRA, and Treasury. So following a very successful pilot in 2021, the year after, it was implemented with the aim of, or the broader objective, to safeguard the country's economic stability. So yes, it is designed to test the cyber resiliency of those considered to be at the core of the financial market system. It's meant to ask the question, what is the capability look like to withstand cyber attacks? And actually, we're seeing this these kind of schemes popping up all around the globe now as well. Some that have done so before us in Australia. So we're seeing regulators pushing for that greater operational resilience, whether it's the Bank of England CBES scheme to TIBER in Europe, which was the European Central Bank scheme. And most recently, actually, Canada last year introduced something called ICERT. So increasingly, we're seeing these long-term integration of cyber resilience programs at an international level. And frankly, as is evidenced, probably that is the de facto gold standard for intelligence-led exercises.
Yeah, let's drill into that too, because a key part of this is that these attack simulations are, as I kind of said in the intro, designed to mimic what, real threat actors would use. And that, of course, involves, collecting a certain amount of threat intelligence on the latest, TTPs and behaviors of attack groups. So how do you, I guess, kind of structure this from an intelligence level? What kind of threat intelligence do you draw upon? And then I guess, does it, when you're creating, what goes into creating this, an attack scenario?
Yeah, sure. So part of that, this framework, there's two main phases. One is the attack preparation, and the second is the attack execution. So Willem's team, the adversary simulation group, is the attack execution, and the whole exercise is front-loaded with threat intelligence. So that's our part, and that's the attack preparation. What we do is we agree before the engagement commences, we agree with the financial institution or the participant. And the CFR on a key of critical business services to target for that organization. So using threat intelligence, we use the different light, we draw up a threat matrix of capability and intent of different threat actors to target that organization, what their modus operandi looks like, drawing on the MITRE ATT&CK framework to draw out what those TTPs look like. And also it's then Willem's team that then emulates a threat scenario, which is kind of like a blueprint, which we break down using the cyber kill chain to then go and conduct the attack. But it's all based on real world threats. So it's for us, it's based on our intelligence holdings that we have, whether that's from open and closed sources. We also have, one of the largest in region DFIR if not the largest, in region DFIR capability. So we draw a lot of intelligence from what we're seeing in and around Australia. So we're well placed to do these engagements.
And even to before we get into the attack part, which I'll come over to you, Willem, about just to even step back when you're like looking at certain kinds of I guess attack simulations and what you would decide. How much does stepping back? How much do geopolitical events I guess play into I guess creating an attack scenario?
Well, I'd say geopolitical events are pretty crucial in the role of evolution of cyber attacks, especially when it comes to any threat actor that has noteworthy capabilities. State-backed threat actors, ideologically motivated actors, cyber criminal groups, they all operate within those politically influenced environments. So that intersection of cyber and global politics always is going to create that constantly shifting landscape, which underscores how those threat actors will adapt, how they intensify or strategically redirect some of their efforts based on those geopolitical priorities. So for example, the South China Sea, very contentious. There's a greater focus on targeting Australian entities with connections to maritime and defense industries. So it shapes their targeting. We've also seen from ideologically motivated actors, and some of those, claim allegiance to a cause, but who actually might be affiliated or state-sponsored group. We've seen that too with groups such as Cyber Avengers. And also the attacks such as Wiper malware, which they employ, due to some of the conflicts that happened in the Middle East, for example. So yes, it definitely plays a very, very large part in how threat actors evolve and change their tactics and TTPs.
Willem, a question for you on when you go to work. Interesting slice that I read in some of the attack or some of the CORI materials was that CORI exercises mimic adversaries through fewer traditional testing restrictions and longer time duration to fully exploit opportunities. I know like I've spoken with a lot of pen testers and things in the past, and they're always like, oh, the scope was really small and they had other issues, but we were really constrained and we had to deliver this report. How does this sort of is that what's in scope and what's not in scope, and does it vary with when you're doing one of these, or is it more expansive? Like could you do phone-based phishing, some other attack vectors that I guess have cropped up particularly lately?
Well, you actually touched on probably some of my favorite topics and reasons why we love this framework. Because I'm gonna before we talk about the scope, the physical scope, and the entry methods, etc. The one thing that I do want to touch on is the time durations, right? CORI does set out slightly, longer time frames, and it serves a couple of couple of key purposes. Like firstly. If you talk to any red teamer, if you ask him on any job that they've done, what do you think you needed or wish you had to complete this job? And I promise you, they say time. You can never have enough time, right? That is the bane of our existence. And it's always the argument that an attacker has infinite time. We have whatever we
Yeah.
scope or paid for, right? And we need to work within those constraints. Now, CORI doesn't give you infinite time. However, it does create a standard set of timelines. Because one of the nice things about this framework is that yes, it's done by multiple providers. But one of the things that's sort of been a little bit problematic in the industry is that how do you compare red teams between different organizations and different even with between different red teamers, right? Some organizations might run it for 2 weeks, some might want to run it for 6 months. You can then you can't compare the outcomes of those two tests because they are vastly different. And by the framework sort of setting out these are the durations or the blocks that we're working in and sort of that's that you should plan for. It kind of creates a little bit more comparison between different red teams over different years by different providers or even by different red teams, which is absolutely, I think, key for what they want to do. And it does show in the results as well, because we've got better more time, it actually sort of leads to better results, specifically for these bigger organizations that we work with. Now to the fun part in terms of what we're allowed to do. Yes, scope is typically, much, much bigger, because the scope is sort of defined by, the CBS or the critical business systems that we want to go after, as well as what was discovered during the TI phase with Diego's team, right? If we see that an adversary is, going after a specific, or his system or sets data, and they go along, they've got various ways of doing that. We want to bring that in, right? So we can't just say, oh, we don't want to fish, because we do see some organizations still have a little bit of resistancy to this, to things like that. If your actor that you're emulating is favoring phishing, we're going to go down that route. That said, there is one thing. Sorry, I'm talking a lot now.
That's all right.
One thing, that said, what we also do when we create the scenarios, right? We also need to be sort of realistic, and we take the input from the TI report, and we can see, okay, well, look, there might be some entry vectors which are not necessarily feasible for our organization if we map it back to the known TI for a specific actor, right? And then, during the planning, we'll work with the customer and the TI team to sort of find alternative pathways, because no actor has a single, single, weapon in their arsenal, right? They do have some different ones. So we do work with that. We work with it within the constraints of the TI, but also we do find that it's much broader, right? And it's yielding good success for us. Sorry, that was
And
about.
Diego, I mean, as far as scenarios too, I mean, obviously ransomware is still pretty much off the hook this year. It's looking like a, record year for at least the number of attacks too. It seems like some organizations are not paying as frequently and not as much, but still, it's still pretty bad. And then you have sort of financially motivated, other, just sort of fraudster level. Like when you're doing financial services, like what are you looking for of like resistance to disruption or resistance to ransomware, or is it a bunch of different things depending on the institution that's being tested?
Yes, it is a bunch of different things, but we don't articulate these threat scenarios on a whim. We stick to what we're seeing in real world. So back to the question about, is everything and everything considered in scope? Yes, but as long as we're simulating or mimicking what we're observing, what's current. I think the question kind of intimates that, oh, how much novel stuff can you introduce, and how much is based on a whim? But it's not. We have to very much stick to what we're observing, and as long as it aligns with current threat actor tradecraft, and also it needs to get approved, obviously, by the what's called the control group. But for example, some of the more novel things we've done in inverted commas might be we've lately seen North Korean actors applying for jobs, especially for Western companies, those in the US tech sector. That's something that we've also looked at doing for participants, but that would require concessions and possibly lengthier approvals to do. But those are the kind of things that what we do. So we do insider threat. We give alternative pathways to some of those initial access vectors. But we're testing for everything, and part of the testing is who is the threat actor and what's their motivation. So if the participant is if we once we draw out the threat matrix and say these are the likeliest threat actors to target you, normally it's going to be a nation state perhaps, or as you mentioned, a cyber extortion group, ideologically motivated actors. Their capabilities obviously a little bit lower. They're flying the ointment sometimes. They do have some successes, DDoS attacks, minutes, maybe hours, but very different actions on objectives. So we look at a broad spectrum, but we pick out the likeliest threat actors and look to simulate those and the TTPs that they use.
Yeah, great. And I read another really interesting bit when I was doing my background in about this, and CyberCX blog post mentioned that occasionally the exercise doesn't necessarily you don't it goes out of an exercise because you have to break the fourth wall is how it's sort of termed. Can you explain a little bit why these exercises sometimes get interrupted because of, I guess, sort of reconnaissance that you've or intelligence that you've uncovered?
Yes, well, I think there's two types there. It's either from our reconnaissance that we've uncovered, or it's because during an engagement, there's actually a real world attack happening at the participant, which means we have to stop anyway, right? Because we need to deconflict. Things happen. But yes, when it comes to the reconnaissance part of that, it's normally we come to an agreement at the start of the engagement, say, we were going to find some things, and if we find something that we deem is critical, we will notify you straight away. We come to an agreement what that might be. Sometimes we find legacy infrastructure with critical vulnerabilities that are actively being exploited in the wild, and they appear in Sizer's known exploited vulnerability catalog.
Wow.
So that's a rare case. More often, we would find something that's access being advertised for a corporate network access, and we notify them straight away and make sure that proper due course is taken with that.
Willem, when you kick it off, do the defenders know you're coming? Is there some, or does their socks just like it's just a normal day and they're just,
Yeah, so in the ideal world, the idea behind Cori is to keep it as realistic as possible. So, like the Diego said, there's the concept of a control group, which basically serves as the sort of the purveyor of knowledge or for this engagement. Blue teams are not supposed to know. And we do create during the planning phase, like a whole set of rules of engagement about like how are we going to keep it as realistic as long as possible. And that just means, if we get detected, we don't immediately tell the blue team that, hey, this is a red team. They need to work a bit,
Sure,
see if they can properly attribute it, see if they can actually figure out what was going on, and follow their BAU processes as far as they possibly can. Because I mean that is that that in itself is fairly crucial learnings for any of the participants to see how their team holds up, how they react, and actually does their theoretical playbooks that they've created, does it hold? Can they be successful against a motivated actor? In some cases, yes, unfortunately, we do have some slip-ups where, maybe somebody, let slip that it's a red team and things like that. That always happens. You can't 100% maintain secrecy all the time. But by and large, we do keep it as far as away from the blue team as possible.
I've heard in ransomware scenarios where there's this like the adversary hands on keyboard and the defender's hands on keyboard, and it's like this really sort of pitched battle that happens while they're trying to like kind of maintain access. So you don't necessarily like when they pull your flag and you're like, oh, we're done. It's like you keep going
Yeah,
sometimes.
so that's the you're talking about the real fun part now. So typically we try to avoid avoid detection as much as we can, playing by the rules of the intelligence that we have. But sometimes, yes, defenders do pick a, can pick us up and they can actively go after us. And make no mistake, we do fight back, and it's and depending on the organization that we work with, there's one thing I do need to mention. Going back to the duration of these exercises, the side effect of it being so long is that there's actually a relationship that forms between the red teamers and the actual control group and the organization that takes part. So, at the start, everything is nervous energy. People, it's like you're going out on a first date almost. Yeah, by the end, when we're going after flags, they're egging us on, or it's a really good vibe. And usually, even if we do hit the flag, let's say we've hit the flag, but we've not been fully identified or kicked out, we won't stop. We'll work with the team and say, hey, can we ramp this up? What should we do? Let's give the blue team a run for their money. Let's see how long it takes them to kick us out. And then we'll have a right go at them. And I mean, we've done some cool stuff, like jumping into their Slack channels and actually watching what they're doing, or
That, 'cause that's exactly what happens in some scenarios too.
Yeah,
Yeah.
we've one of my favorite things that we've done once the blue team is very, I must say, the blue team is very angry with us. Initially, they in the second red team, they said, like, they'll watch for that now. But in one of the engagements, we actually, dropped the beacon onto one of the main blue teamers' machine, and we were actually actively monitoring his desktop while they were sitting in calls, and we were snooping on their team sessions while they're discussing this potential incident, and we were actually closing tickets on his behalf and things like that, which, look, we disclosed all of the information, but that was part of the fight back,
Sure,
sitting inside the team looking for alerts to pop up, etc. And that's part of the game, right?
Just leave that I gotcha account in the domain controller and I could find later. So when it's done, what happens next? There's sort of a purple team and a gold team. Explain to me those concepts and how does that shake out?
Yeah, so those are actually probably some of the most valuable exercises coming out of this, right? So, the red team is, we go out, we sort of work under the cover of darkness, and then we slap people with a big 200 page report or something to that effect. And that typically, appears to be overwhelming. But what these purple and red team exercises does is it gives the defenders the opportunity to sit with the attackers, and actually, yes, we do the replay of it. Yes, we delve into the technical side of things, but almost the mo most important part of that and the most valuable part of that is for the defenders to actually pick the brain of the red team, right? Because a lot of it is, yes, we can see you've made a technical choice, you've executed something specifically, but what the defenders won't know from the logs is why. Why did the guy decide to do this? Why did he go for this tactic as opposed to that? Why was this box chosen as opposed to that one? What made you pick it? What made you go down this avenue? And during the purple teaming and parts of the gold teaming as well, those questions, those interactions probably provide the most value to the blue teams. It's great for knowledge transfer, sort of like giving a different perspective, etc. And with gold teaming, where we take the engagement and we replay it from a management perspective, making sure that hey, this has happened. How do you handle it? Look, during the engagement, there are controls to sort of prevent somebody from, prematurely letting the media know, etc. But there's a lot of things that need to happen during a real breach that, it's really hard to sort of, practice for that. But when we do these call teams, you've actually got a playbook of something that has happened in your organization. There's real points that you can point to, real timelines that you can say, like, this is when we first saw it. This is what happened. This was the time delay between this and that, and this is the data that was, that was compromised. And then you can basically craft that exercise by telling us, like, okay, this has happened. How do we do this now? How do we proceed? Do we notify? Who do we notify? Things like and that is invaluable. And we actually within CyberCX, my team, handles part of that, but we've also got a team that specializes in that, because that is almost a specialized discipline, sort of dealing with a breach incident, everything from media comms, etc. And my team works with that team to perform these gold team exercises.
And Diego, a question for you about CTI then too. And after one of these exercises happens, does the organization that had it conducted have some rear view kind of insight into what's the most valuable CTI? I mean, I know that's kind of like the question that a lot of organizations have, a lot of questions that we have of like, there's so much CTI. How do you filter it? What's of most use for your organization? And then how do you prioritize? Do you find that some organizations were more reflective in their, I guess, consumption of CTI after one of these exercises?
Yes and no. Realistically, I think the thing to say is that I think financial services industry, one of the most tightly regulated industries. There's a lot of governance and compliance that is mandated. They've got large, kind of deeper pockets than most as well. So normally they'll have in-house threat intelligence teams. They've already done things like, what did our threat profile look like? It's good to get reassurance or validation for them by an external provider. The threat intelligence that we provide or that anyone, any provider provides as part of these engagements gets validated also by the ACSC or the RBA by their own threat intelligence team, and they provide enrichment where it's necessary, but it kind of gets marked as well. So they're able to see what we're doing is aligning with government and what they're seeing. But really it comes down to you know, continue partaking in these robust and rigorous programs to test your resiliency for real world threats. This is part of your defense. It's also building defense in-depth strategies. You know, the paradigm has shifted. I think that's one of the quotes in the blog post we posted. Stop focusing on prevention, focus on resilience. You know, segregate your network. Make sure that, you know, if a threat actor does compromise part of that network, they've got a beachhead, but it's segregated away from your critical business functions or assets. So I think it gives some organizations pause, especially when Willem's team, who's very capable, are able to find many holes that they can get through. But yeah, it does provide food for thought for a lot of organizations.
And as a final question, what are some of the, I guess, areas that sort of consistently emerge where financial services should build better, resiliency? Is it kind of like, forgotten infrastructure? Is it unpatched vulnerabilities? Is it, identity and access management issues? All of the above? Anything stand out for you, either?
Look, the sad part is, yes, there is commonality. Diego said, touched on, with those big organizations, they've got bigger budgets, right? They've got typically bigger teams. However, they've got monstrous estates, like, and also, these big financial institutions, they're dragging decades of technical debt, right? So yes, we do typically see some, your classical vulnerabilities, et cetera, but on the perimeter, not as much because, I mean, it's they're regulated, right? So they are incentivized to actually find those. But what we do find consistently, is around identities, specifically gaps around, controls, specifically, multi-factor authentication. I mean, there's a big push for that. It's been like that for years. But with the way networks work and working from home and all of these complexities that's been introduced, there's always gaps. There are always, as we say, edge cases. And, attackers are getting better at finding that. And for us, we don't necessarily at this point in time, well, I'm talking about my team, but I mean, I'm pretty sure most of the red teamers in the world are, is probably, feeling the same way. We don't necessarily covet, vulnerabilities or, machines inside networks anymore. We crave credentials, we crave identities. Because, I mean, if we have identities, we don't need to worry about exploitation. Right, because we can seamlessly move, and that sort of dovetails into some of the other, the big failures that we see. So one of the biggest common problems that we've identified over the last couple of years is still almost cyber hygiene with the way credentials, for example, are handled inside of organizations. Yes, password managers, yes, PAM solutions, yes, if all of those things exist. If people are, creating scripts that constantly export credentials to text files to make it easier for themselves, because we've got, overly cumbersome controls, that makes system administrators' lives difficult, that is a problem. Credentials live in specifically in these big organizations in places where they never consider it. It's amazing how often we find credentials, and not just using them as a passwords, everything from API keys, access tokens, things like that. We find it in every place, from file shares, Confluence, SharePoint. It's amazing, right? And the moment that we have that, we typically sort of bypass almost the most important and heavily relied upon piece of defensive tech that organizations are using right now, which is EDR.
Yes.
right? If
Yeah.
you know, I have to fight with EDR, and then there's some good EDR out there right now. You know, every time that I have to try and bypass it or disable it or hide from it, I risk being detected, right? Because that's a cat and mouse game. That is, constant, trying to one up one another. However, if I've got the right credentials, I can literally log in and I can look at your EDR and go like, I don't need to worry about that because I'm just going to be a user.
Yeah.
And that's really, been a common thing, a common theme over the last couple of years, that once we get there, we notice the overreliance on EDR. Once we get past that, with actual identities, it usually goes pretty quick.
Living off the land.
Yeah. That's the
That's
thing.
excellent. Well, that's a good thing to keep out, watch out for. Thank you both so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Awesome.